Welcome to another exciting episode of NIDS Knowledge, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we advance peace, promote stability, and help you to think deterrence. This episode is part of our regular Deterrence Down Under series, focused on Australia and our deterrence challenges in the Indo-Pacific region. Good day from Canberra. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello, all. I'm your host, Dr. Carl Rhodes, and in today's show, we're going to be examining options for extended AUKUS cooperation. This is part of our NIDS Knowledge Deterrence Down Under series, and today I have Natalie Treylor from India Alpha Consulting joining me from Canberra, and Bob Peters, Senior NIDS Fellow and Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, joining us from the Washington, D.C. region. Disclaimers today that the views of our hosts and our guests are their own and don't necessarily represent any institution they may be affiliated with. So before we jump into that topic, I've got a little small recurring theme we're going to introduce called deterrence myth busting down under. And I should probably say it in like some kind of Darth Vader voice. But the goal of this is to correct some fallacious thinking floating around here in Australia. And so Australia's national defense strategy that was just released, and you know, much of the strategy that was discussed before, is based on a deterrence by denial strategy. Yet a number of defense commentators here have written pieces about deterrence by denial that leads me to quote Inigo Montoya from The Princess Bride. I do not think it means what you think it means. So Natalie, maybe you can help us out first by talking about what is deterrence by denial? How does it differ from deterrence by punishment?
So I'm going to use Michael Mazar's Ready Reckoner to help us get through this today. He describes deterrence as the practice of discouraging or restraining an actor from taking unwanted actions, such as an armed attack. It involves an effort to stop or prevent an action, and the concept of deterrence is related to but different from compellence, which is an effort to force an actor to do something. There are two central approaches to deterrence, where deterrence by denial strategies seek to deter an action by making it infeasible or unlikely to succeed, therefore denying a potential aggressor confidence in attaining objectives, such as deploying sufficient military forces to defeat an invasion, including missile defences, precision strike weapons, whereas deterrence by punishment threatens severe penalties if an attack occurs, such as a nuclear escalation or economic sanctions. Studies indicate that denial strategies are more reliable than punishment strategies, as steps taken to deny signal visible force, such as placing considerable military capabilities in the way of an attacker, in contrast to an attacker doubting a defender's willingness to impose punishments. Christine captures the limitations of denial strategies in her book titled The Consequences of American Nuclear Disarmament. Including success or failure of denial strategies is difficult to forecast, and the arrival of nuclear weapons crafted a credible threat of retaliatory punishment. However, the advantage of deterrence by denial is that we reduce the likelihood of success should deterrence fail. Hence, US allies, including Australia, are pursuing advanced military capabilities, grander defence industrial base integration, and enhanced force postures to augment deterrence by denial and increase the resiliency of the regional security order. Hence, we need to think through these denial capabilities, and Bob Peters is here to explain how he sees allies in the Asia Pacific contributing to deterrence.
Yep. So we'll totally get back to that, but just to be clear, there's no location associated with deterrence by denial versus deterrence by punishment, because some of the experts here have said, you know, oh, Australia's going to have a strategy of deterrence by denial. We'll never need to strike the Chinese mainland. Is that correct, Natalie?
That's true.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just came back from a NATO Integrated Air and Missile Defense Conference where, you know, Ukraine is facing attacks by long-range missiles. You know, they can do some things to defend, but to deny those missile strikes, they'll probably need to strike Russian territory from some places where those missiles are being launched from. And if Australia really wishes to deter and deny Chinese missile threats in the future, one way is to try to defend, but it's a losing game. If you really want to have the ability to deny those missile strikes, you may need the ability to strike the Chinese mainland. Now, there are questions as to whether that would be escalatory or not, but such strikes against the mainland could be part of a deterrence by denial strategy. So that's why I wanted to bring that up and kind of counter those ideas that are floating around out there that Australia would never need to strike the Chinese mainland as part of deterrence by denial. So that closes up myth busting down under. We'll get into today's regular scheduled program. And Bob, you've written quite a bit on ways that AUKUS can take us even further than might be planned currently in Pillars 1 and 2. Can you tell us more about your thoughts in that area?
Yeah, thanks, and thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here with you all. So I think AUKUS is a good start, and I understand some of the concerns about, like American shipbuilding industry right now is a hot mess. There's no two ways around that. I think every class of ship is going to be 18 months to 36 months delayed. It's not great. And so I understand the concern that we may not be able to, the Americans may not be able to sell Virginia SSNs within the timeframes that's been established within AUKUS, which then could have put at risk some of the Australian national security concerns. And that's a very legitimate concern to have. I do not deny that that's a legitimate concern. And I think that's why you're seeing such an emphasis right now with the United States on, no kidding, open more shipyards. And you've got testimony this week going on in the Senate Armed Services Committee and the House Armed Services Committee within Congress. And I'm telling you, the senators and congressmen are taking both the Naval and Air Force leadership, to task on get the DIB, the Defense Industrial Base, in order and by God, start cranking out platforms. So I just, that's kind of this, setting the stage. When it comes to AUKUS, what I would like to see beyond Pillar 1 and Pillar 2, and I think Pillar 2 is terrific as well, I would like to see, in my mind, Pillar 3 of AUKUS, and then I can kind of talk about, like, Quad 2.0, because I'd like to see a Pillar 2 and then a Pillar 3 within the Quad, which in some ways I think has more potential even than AUKUS. But Pillar 3 would be actual, no kidding, production of munitions and ships within Australia and the UK. And so by that, I mean, I would love to see AUKUS-class SSNs, and how close they are to Virginia's or how different they are from Virginia's, I kind of don't care. Like, I want to make sure that you've got effective combat capability and whatever those SSNs are that are effective within the Western Pacific. And I see no reason why Australia cannot have its own dedicated shipyard that cranks out one SSN AUKUS per year, and the same with UK. And I think that there's a good argument to be made to put American taxpayer dollars into just such a shipyard and into jobs for Australia so they could be, and UK, to be cranking those things out. And so I'm very open to a Pillar 3. It's not just SSNs either. I'm very open to doing long-range precision strike munitions with Australia. I think there's a lot of opportunity there from an AUKUS perspective. From a Quad perspective, I actually think the Quad is underserved. I mean, there was a lot of brouhaha when the Quad was announced, and I'm not sure how much has come out after that. But frankly, you know, India plus Japan plus US plus Australia is a pretty darn powerful combination. And I would like to see a point where the Quad can get to where they're also doing technology sharing and technology collaboration and just idea generation when it comes to these defense capabilities. But frankly, like, I see no reason why you can't get to a Quad in which Japan, US, and Australia are cranking out long-range precision strike munitions, are cranking out common destroyers and frigates that all three navies can use. And then what India can bring to that is maybe it's not that high-end stuff, but maybe they can make a crap ton of cheap disposable drones. And, like, frankly, and I'm not a drone guy, like, I'll say it up front, but I think from what we've seen in the battlefields of Ukraine and increasingly what we're seeing in the Middle East is there is a real future in this kind of bifurcated architecture of drones in which you've got the high-end MQ-9 Reapers, right? The super high-end, super precise thing, platform that can do ISR, and oh, by the way, it's got like six hard points on it that you can put six Hellfires on. It can be kind of a mothership eye in the sky Overwatch, and then all this cheap disposable crap. And I think actually India could do some real good on cranking out large scales amounts of the cheap disposable UAVs, but then also potentially the MQ-9B Is that the Witch Tail, Sidewinder, whatever that is? But it's the MQ-9B, in which they could actually be producing that as well. And so I think if you get to a quad, Pillar 2 and Pillar 3, that kind of mimics AUKUS, then you can get to some real interesting stuff to deter China, which to me is the goal.
Yeah, exactly. I think we've seen here in Australia some movement towards increasing those relationships and cooperation between Japan, U.S., and Australia, for sure.
Right.
There was just a recent announcement about cooperation on integrated air and missile defense, where U.S. and Japan have obviously been working quite closely together. Yep. Australia's been a few steps behind just because the threat hasn't been there until just recently to drive that system. But I think there's some interesting ways. And Japan's actually been working on building, I think it was the SM-3 Block 2, yep, in conjunction with the United States. So that's a good example of munitions cooperation, right?
No, absolutely. And if what we've seen anything from the Iranian assault on Israel over this past weekend before recording, 97 to 99% interception rate, and including the first, if I'm not mistaken, the first exo-atmospheric interception of a ballistic missile in actual combat situations. And now, look, I'm willing to say that Chinese missiles and drones are better than Iranian drones. I'm willing to concede that point. But my God, if you're shooting down 97 to 99% of their stuff, even against a more advanced adversary like China, like, let's go. Let's be cranking out the SM-3s, the SM-6s, the Aero-3s, you name it. And let's just make an overlapping impenetrable dome along the first island chain that's an anchor down in Australia. I'm 100% on board with that.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's that demonstration of IAMD capability was quite impressive by Israel, and took a lot of coordination because, you know, there were fighter aircraft in the air shooting down cruise missiles and drones. Yep. There was, you know, various defensive systems shooting down, you know, ballistic missiles. And so how you integrate all that shows the reason why Australia really needs to care about the Air 6500 Phase 1 program, which is working on command and control for that IAMD. It was just recently approved that Lockheed's going to work on it back in August, I believe. So critically important that gets worked out. How about munitions? Let's talk about that. So, Natalie, do you have any insight as to how munitions are going? I have some thoughts, but, you know, how's the sovereign munition, you know, building capability working?
So the sovereign capability building program is underway on paper, from what we can see. Australia's extant strike capability is quite limited. So we have our six Collins-class submarines that have a 20,000-kilometre range. These provide our longest-range anti-submarine, anti-ship, land strike and mining capabilities. The eight Anzac-class frigates and three Hobart-class destroyers have a range of 10,000 kilometres and are capable of air defence, surface and undersea warfare. Our Air Force has 24 FA-18F Super Hornets, which in conjunction with 72 F-35A Lightning IIs and 6 EA-18 Growlers provide Australia with air combat capabilities. The F-18s and F-35A aircraft have a range of roughly 2,700 and 2,200 kilometres respectively and can be loaded with air-to-surface and air-to-air weapons. The Growler provides Australia with electronic attack capabilities to disrupt electronic systems, including radar and communications. Australia has no anti-satellite missiles, but Australia is just one of two countries with the capabilities to neutralise large numbers of satellites passing over its territory. And Australia's offensive cyber operations sit under ASD, which is the Australian Signals Directorate, and that involves a broad range of offshore activities designed to deter, disrupt, degrade and deny adversaries in support of government national security priorities. In addition to Australia's plan to acquire a total of eight nuclear power submarines under AUKUS in the 2030s, the Hunter-class frigates will begin to enter service in the 2030s to replace the Anzac-class frigates. And Australia will enhance its long-range strike capabilities through purchasing 220 Tomahawk land attack missiles with 1,700-kilometre range that may be launched from naval ships or submarines. The Joint Air-to-Surface Standoff Missile with a 930-kilometre range for air combat aircraft and 42 land-based surface-to-surface high-mobility artillery rocket systems, the HIMARS launchers, that will be equipped with the Precision Strike Missile that will have a 500-kilometre range. Bearing in mind that all of this arms transfer has been enabled by the US in response to China's assertive behavior in the Indo-Pacific and Russia's invasion of the 22 of Russia's 22 invasion of Ukraine.
Yeah, that's a pretty good summary of, you know, the force structure here. So, I mean, one of the issues is, Bob, is that, you know, the range of some of these systems doesn't get you anywhere close to, you know, the South China Sea or Taiwan in terms of extended operations. It's nothing like a B-21 or a B-2 capabilities that the United States has, and the refueling, you know, capabilities. There are some in the ADF, but they're somewhat limited. So, you know, what about options for Australia that might consider, you know, right now there's hosting of U.S. forces on a rotational basis that could include bombers. Are there other options that we should be considering in your mind?
Yeah, so great question. And look, those are all great systems. And look, I think I'm on record as saying we need Raiders of the Lost Ark size warehouses full of these types of systems spread all across the planet. But you're right. I mean, the range is not where they need to be, particularly given Australia's relation to kind of to the central front, right, which is the Chinese coast. I think yesterday the U.S. Army had its first deployment of the Typhon class launcher onto an island in the Philippines. And the Typhon, again, can launch a variety of different systems. That's good. And the Philippines is a relevant geography to the centrality of the fight. I think we need to look at forward deployment of capabilities to get us closer to the fight. Because frankly, Australia, the geography is such that unless you forward deploy, you're just not going to have the range to be able to impact the fight if you want to deny the absorption of Taiwan or the Philippines by China. And so then it becomes forward deployment. I mean, look, you guys are in better shape than we are, right? Like, we're like 8,000 miles away. But that's why you need to look at what's the terrain, what's the geography in which you can forward deploy, you know, HIMARS, ground-launched ATACMS, SM-3s, SM-6s, you name it. And I think that's actually where the relationship with the Philippines is going to become more and more important. And I think that's why you're seeing the United States rehabilitating islands like around Tinian and so forth, so that we can generate launches out of those places. And as far as the B-21s go, I'm very open to selling B-21s to key allies such as Australia and Japan, so that they're able to get the range. And they don't need to be a ton. But if Australia or Japan were to acquire, say, 20 B-21s apiece, that could launch a variety of those systems that Natalie just identified. From multiple different axes, right? And so then China's looking at potential Americans coming from the east and Australians coming from the southeast and Japanese coming from the northeast in basically sixth-generation bombers. Boy, I would hate to be a Chinese air defense planner looking at that kind of scenario. And so I really do think that's kind of the future, is this integration of advanced naval platforms like the frigates and destroyers that can launch some of these systems, like F-35s and B-21s that can deliver some of these systems, as well as forward deploying ground-based systems in places like the Philippines. And I think the Filipinos are willing to deal. I joke about this sometimes, but I kind of feel like if we were to offer to like clear out all the Maoist guerrillas on one of their islands and then we get to like place weapon systems there, that's like a win-win for both sides. And maybe we got to talk about, you know, smoking the Maoists on those islands so we can put Typhon launchers there.
Fantastic idea. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, like, one of the challenges probably for Australia and Japan is, you know, the B-21 advanced capability, probably going to need, you know, some advanced systems to go with it, you know, just the B-21 by itself. But I am a big believer in long-range strike of some kind for Australia especially. In my opinion, might not necessarily need to be the B-21, could be an arsenal aircraft that could dump off a ton of cruise missiles. That might be interesting as well. But you need to buy the munitions. That's one of the keys, I think. And you know, that's one of the challenges here in Australia. They've talked about building up a guided weapons explosive ordnance enterprise here. And it's moving dreadfully slowly, in my opinion. This was first talked about in 2020, I believe, or 2021. And you know, there hasn't been much progress made. The goal right now is in 2025 to be, you know, assembling these Gimler's weapons here. So they get all the parts here and they basically do the final assembly here. And that's 2025. So we're not talking this is moving at light speed. What kind of capabilities do you think would be useful in terms of munition stockpile that, you know, we should be worried about for conflict, you know, or deterrence?
So great questions. And I think getting a variety of Gimler's capabilities is really helpful, and especially as you diversify where those forces are based. Again, it creates targeting challenges for the adversary. But I think you don't have, and I take your point really well, Carl, that you don't need to get like the super high-tech B-21, and maybe you don't even need to get the F-35. I mean, there's some interesting things going on with Rapid Dragon, which is basically you put a whole bunch of cruise missiles on a pallet, and then literally some airmen kick the pallet out of the back end of a cargo aircraft, you know, and then the things fire like fireworks and go and home in on a predetermined target. Those are some things you can do. People have been talking about filling up containers, Connexes, full of cruise missiles as well, that can either be subsurface or put on top of a container ship or wherever. You blow the lid off the box and it starts firing those things. Those are some cheaper options than getting, I don't know how much it's going to be, a $900 million B-21 a pop. So those are some things you certainly could do. And I kind of like the mix, right? I kind of like the super high-end, super premium mix of the B-21, whether you want to call it a sixth-generation aircraft or whatever, but also some dumb things like, can we take a C-130 and kick a pallet off the ass end of it and have it fire off a crap ton of JASSM ERs? I'm very open to that. I really do think from a deterrence perspective, we need a whole lot of JASSM ERs. Because of the range on those suckers, but I also think we need a lot more of LRASMs, long-range anti-ship missiles, to be able to try to destroy the Chinese ships before they go off. And if I were advising people, what I would be saying is be looking at JASSM ERs, TLAMs, SM-3s for integrated air and missile defenses, and LRASMs. I mean, I think those are kind of the critical capabilities.
Yeah, I think all of those would turn around the conundrum that typically we've thought of China posing to the United States and its allies with its large number of missiles, turn around the conundrum and let them consider how to deal with a large number of cruise missiles, drones, you know, guided weapons, glide weapons, all those kind of things coming at them at one time. Right. And it's a difficult challenge, right?
Yeah. Right. From three different axes of advance, if you're coming from Japan and the Philippine Sea, from the Americans, and then from Australia, from the Southeast, my God.
Yeah, big challenge. One other thing I had on the list here, and this gets a little bit beyond extending AUKUS, but would like your thoughts on, you know, China is currently growing its nuclear forces dramatically, right? You know, they're building silos in the desert and appear to be adding a lot of nuclear weapons. Australia doesn't have nuclear weapons and doesn't have plans for them at the moment. But, you know, how might Australia work with its allies like the United States to enhance deterrence against nuclear forces, you know, that extended deterrence piece? How does Australia play a more active role in that? Because it's usually been a passive observer on that side.
So it's a really important question, and I'll just, you know, I'll kind of tap the sign and say, as we all know, and we all agree, deterrence is more than just nuclear. It's their conventional forces have a critically important role in deterrence, just like missile defenses has a critical and important role to play in deterrence. And so I think from a strictly Australian perspective, the ability to intercept, so now deterrence by denial, intercept incoming Chinese warheads, however they're delivered, is critically important. The resiliency piece, that's also deterrence by denial. The ability to reconstitute forces, whether that is doing sustainment for ships, you know, American or Japanese or whatever ships that come in, and they need refueling or they need some like battle damage repair or whatever, that's important. The ability to support agile combat employment of allied aircraft moving from point A to point B so they're not targeted, or maybe a base is destroyed and so they need a new home place. That's all part of deterrence by denial. So let's say the Chinese decided to use a nuclear weapon on Guam. We think about that a lot in the United States, right? Those planes need to go someplace else. The ability to generate forces if you lose Guam becomes really important. So that becomes an important part of deterrence by denial. Now, deterrence by punishment Then you could get into, well, if Australia had the ability to do long-range precision fires on key targets on the Chinese homeland and go after those DF-21, DF-26 batteries, however that is, whether that is long-range fires coming off of an Australian B-21 or long-range fires coming off of an Australian destroyer or a rocket in a box, whatever you, Rapid Dragon, whatever you want to do, those are all important contributions. And, I think that's, and I'm not trying to undersell that at all. Like, Australia has a lot of good capability that we should leverage, and I'm really encouraged because everything that I've been seeing is Australia takes the security challenges within their own region very seriously. And that's to me, it's, I wish more of our allies took things as seriously as our allies do in Australia and Japan and Korea.
Yeah, exactly. I think there actually has been a stepping up. I just came back from a NATO conference last week, and it seems like NATO has stepped up not only their rhetoric and words, but also their actions. It was one of the first, NATO conferences I've been to in a long time where people said, oh, we have money to spend on interesting proposals. Usually, most NATO conferences and other defense conferences say, we're limited in budget. We don't have anything, to give you. But Australia is stepping up as well. It's a challenge. I mean, the one interesting thing that I noticed from the NATO conference is there's that, group of countries working together towards a common goal and investing together in some way. That's what we don't have here in the Pacific. And I think one of the challenges is how do we work together and create a, an allyship of the willing, not just a set of bilateral relationships to be more, I'd say stand more together in terms of deterrence of China in the future. And so that's a challenge for the future. And that Quad idea is one. Japan, U.S., and Australia working together is another. I don't know if you have any thoughts on Japan or other nations joining, AUKUS, as has been discussed. But that's another way that people have mentioned, creating increased relationships in the region.
I'm open to JAUKUS, right? Japan joining AUKUS, but as I said, I actually think that the more interesting possibilities there are actually trying to invigorate Quad. And so if you took the Quad and had regular working groups, that was the diplomatic side, military side, the military side, it's, you can have subcommittees therein in which there's one that focuses on defense industrial base, one that focuses on common munitions production, one that focuses on shipbuilding and plane building, one that focuses on who does what, and then one that just does on, don't call it like war planning, because I think that's a bridge too far, but maybe you talk about, crisis response proposals or potentials and so forth, because especially when you're dealing with India, things get a little squirrely, but, the Indians actually have moved a tremendous amount in the last 2-3 years. And so it's not, all this is not to say that I'm denigrating AUKUS. I really do fully support AUKUS. And like I said, I want to strengthen it. But I think that if AUKUS moves forward without incorporating India and Japan, I think that's a mistake. Which is why I'm bullish on the Quad.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a very good point. I mean, one of the challenges has been, over time, there's been a number of proposals to reduce export controls and increase, the defense industrial base to include, Australia and other nations. And I think AUKUS is the first time where we've seen the right steps put in place to lower ITAR restrictions, to actually have meaningful sharing and all that. So I think one of the challenges is adding more countries makes it even more complicated. So let's get success here on AUKUS first in terms of that, kind of technology sharing, co-production, all those things, and then think about adding other nations rather than just trying to add, more letters to the acronym at this stage.
And that's fair. And so that's where one of the bonuses to a potential JAUKUS comes in that all, if you want the route of JAUKUS, then every one of those countries that's in JAUKUS is a part of the American extended deterrence nuclear umbrella, right? And I was actually talking with some staff members on Capitol Hill, and I was like, look, I don't know why we're worried about sharing sensitive technologies with the Japanese or the South Koreans or Australians. Because if we're willing to go to nuclear war in the defense of their country and use nuclear weapons in the defense of their country, why in the world are we like, oh, I don't know, though, that's pretty sensitive missile technology. I'm not sure we can share that with them. Like, come on. Like, I kind of feel like you should get a wave on sensitive critical technologies if we're willing to go to nuclear war in defense of our key allies. Like, to me, that's kind of common sense. And I understand it may require, like, change of legislation or change of U.S. law. But that actually may be in the cards if you actually, like, took that as a narrative and be like, we all know we need more munitions, we need more aircraft, we need more ships, we need more shipyards. The special sauce of the liberal democracies is that we all are kind of playing on the same team, so let's use each other's industrial base to actually, you know, get the capabilities that we need rapidly.
Yeah, and I think the unprecedented move of sharing nuclear propulsion technology for submarines with Australia shows that changing mindset, you know, that we do need to change this mindset, you know, as the West, of how we share technology in order to counter this major threat that's, you know, hard to counter by any one nation alone. So
yeah, absolutely.
With that, maybe I'll get some final thoughts. So Natalie, any final thoughts, before we close things up here?
No, I'd just like to thank Bob for coming on the show today, because it's been, you know, great listening to his thoughts.
Yeah. Bob, any final thoughts from you?
No, thanks again. I mean, I really appreciate what you all are doing here and doing this podcast and having these kinds of discussions, because I think it's really important. So, I mean, kudos to you and all the team that supports this effort. So thank you.
Yeah, we'd love to have you back on. You know,
anytime.
Things are moving quickly here, so it'd be great to have you back on. So lots has been happening in Australia. Yesterday we had the release of the National Defense Strategy and the Associated Integrated Investment Program. So our team here is going to be looking into that and digest those documents, and we're going to cover that in a very near future episode as part of Deterrence Down Under. But thanks to Bob. Thanks to Natalie. Thanks all. Take care and have a great day.
Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Deterrence Down Under. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a U.S.-based 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength, alliances, and deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.